I know a lot of people will be excited to know that today we have with us Ron Blue. Ron was with us the end of last year, 1986, and many people wrote in response to our interviews on his newest book called Master Your Money. Ron, good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, John.
Ron is a CPA, a financial planner, but above all else, Ron is a man of God, a man who loves his Lord, and he loves the Word of God. What I appreciate about Ron, among many things, is his emphasis on the Word of God. He begins with biblical truth and then moves into the practical areas when it comes to finances. Ron, what we'd like to do, just a few days away, we have April 15th. It's called D-Day for many people. It's tax time. First of all, I know Romans chapter 13 tells us clearly that we are to pay taxes. Romans chapter 13, verses 5 through 7 says, "Wherefore it is necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath or punishment, but also for conscience sake. For because of this you also pay taxes." Talk about a practical exhortation. "For rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. Render to all what is due them, tax to whom tax is due." Ron, I have a few questions I think you're in a perfect position to answer. First of all, our goal, as you say in your book, is to reduce our effective tax rate. What do you mean by that?
Well, there are, I think people get confused, John. They think because the tax rates are 50% or 28% now, or 33% or 38%, that's what they pay on their total income. When as a reality, your total income is reduced by deductions, exemptions, IRAs, and that type of thing, and then you pay taxes on what's known as taxable income. And when it's all said and done, maybe you have an income of $40,000, you reduce it with exemptions and deductions down to $25,000, and you pay taxes on that. Maybe you pay in the 28% tax bracket, but effectively, when you get it all done, you're only paying taxes maybe at an 8 or 9 or 10%.
So what you're saying is after the deductions, if I make $20,000 and after all the deductions and everything, my taxes were $1,000, I'm really at a 5% effective tax rate.
Exactly. And even though you might have been in the 30% tax bracket, effectively you're only paying 5% taxes.
All right. Well, millions of Americans, millions of people listening would say right now, wait a minute, just a few days away, I've got to file my tax return. Should I get help? I mean, everybody's rushing to the different places that offer some kind of assistance. How do I know when I need help to fill out my tax return?
I think most people seek help not out of confusion as much as they don't want to take the time to do their taxes, and they think that it'll be a little bit easier to go seek the help from a professional. Frankly, except in the very most complex situations, a person can do their own tax return. The instruction booklet that comes along with the Form 1040 is adequate for 95% of the questions that might come up. And my counsel is to do your own taxes, if at all possible, because that's where you learn more about how to plan for taxes for the following year.
It's really an educational process.
Yes.
Going through them.
Mm-hmm.
I have found personally I had help for a number of years and then started to do it myself. It made me much more sensitive to certain deductions that before I was not really taking advantage of.
Oh, yeah, very much so. And I counsel everyone to do it yourself if at all possible. Now, there are excellent places to go for professional help if you need it. I generally recommend a CPA just because that's what their training is for.
Would you recommend that we look for someone to recommend that CPA?
Absolutely would.
How do you feel about, I won't name any major nationwide organizations that offer help, but how do you feel in general about those, that they might find those in a mall at this time of the year? Are they helpful, or is it, again, a matter of finding the right one?
Well, I think that they can be helpful. But you need to understand that they have a very limited objective, and that is they're simply getting your tax return done on the basis of your information. So if your information is no good, the tax return is going to be no good, and they don't help you at all in the area of planning. And that's why I think most people should do their own return.
I have found, too, that most of the effort going into getting my return prepared is just getting the material together. I mean, that's 90% of the work.
Once you've done that, you've almost prepared the return.
I think we also ought to warn the people. The IRS offers help, but they won't stand by their help, will they?
No, they won't.
In other words, if they give us a bum steer, we're going to pay regardless.
You're going to pay. Well, as a matter of fact, you're going to pay regardless, because any tax preparer also says this information is yours and you're the one that stands behind the return. They do not take responsibility for making a mistake unless it's mathematical.
So you go and you pay good money to a CPA. He files your return. There is a mistake. You're still liable.
You are. And he's not going to refund you the money in most cases.
Well, some of us look like we might not reach that April 15th deadline. How do you feel about filing for an extension? How do we do it? When do we do it? Is it prudent? Is it advisable?
Well, you can file an extension up until April 15th and on April 15th for your tax return, but that does not relieve you of paying the actual taxes that you're going to owe. The extension is merely an extension for the filing of the tax return. So if you have a, you still have to estimate what your tax liability is. And if it's, let's say, $1,500 and you've only paid in $1,000 through withholding, along with the extension, you have to file or have to send $500 for the additional taxes due.
So in essence, we almost still have to figure it out, even though we get an extension. We
have to have
some idea of where we're going to be, otherwise pay a penalty.
Yeah, the only real reason to file an extension is because of maybe some missing information. Perhaps a piece of property has sold or somebody hasn't sent you the information that you need to complete your return. That's really the only reason that you should file an extension.
So in other words, you don't accept lack of personal discipline as a reason, right?
No, I don't.
All right. You know, one of the things that a friend of mine shared with me, for a number of years I was filing late. I would pay at least 90%, but I was filing late, and it was a lack of discipline, and I have improved dramatically in that area. He also warned me, though, this friend, he said, you know, you're extending the amount of time they can audit you.
That's
by doing that.
That's right, because the audit time period begins from the date of filing of the return. So if you get an extension to August 15th, there's a three-year time period that they can audit your return, and so it doesn't begin until August 15th rather than April 15th. But an audit shouldn't be anything that someone would be concerned about, and either from the nature of an audit, and if you prepare to return honestly and to the best of your ability, an audit is nothing to be afraid of at all.
Now, primarily Christians are listening, my friend, but you just brought up a word that I think we struggle with when it comes to tax time, and that's the word honesty.
Honesty.
In Ephesians chapter 4, verse 25, we're told to put aside falsehood and speak the truth. Let's talk about some of the areas income-wise that we have to report. This can be confusing for some people.
Yes, it can be, and I think maybe the best way to approach that is that I believe that as a Christian, number one, you should pay some taxes. I mean, that's what Romans 13, verse 7 says that we just read. That's, Jesus also said that when asked whose likeness was on the denarius. And he said, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. And so I think we should be paying some taxes. Secondly, as a Christian, we need to walk in the light. And that means that we're a testimony to the rest of the world. And we don't cheat on our taxes.
This has freed me up, I want you to know. There was a time that I was depending on professional counsel, which in the case of being a minister, and I'm not really under a church, it got rather confusing.
Sure.
And I was trusting someone else to do this. I wasn't keeping up with it. Got myself into a real jam. And I hadn't done anything dishonest. It was a matter of just, who are you? Are you a preacher or not? I used to kid to say that the IRS listened to my tapes and said I wasn't a preacher. But so they really questioned my status. But I have found since then that forcing myself to get educated in this area so I know what I'm doing and then being disciplined to do it has given me freedom, especially when you're honest. Ron, I wish they would audit me. I think I'd get joy out of going in there right now and laying it out.
Yeah, if you've been honest on your return, there's absolutely nothing to fear from an IRS audit. Absolutely nothing.
One more question about the income that I have that I think some people can miss. There was a time that I was going to report income on having sold something that I had previously purchased. In other words, we had a garage sale.
Uh-huh.
And I was ready to report the $200 or $300 that we had made on the garage sale. But it's my understanding that's not income.
No, that's not income. Basically, income is income that you earn or that is earned on a passive basis, such as interest or dividends or rents or something like that. Maybe you're on a board of directors or... Generally speaking, the income that you have to report will come on a Form W-2 or a 1099 of some sort. But sale of property, if it's what's called capital property, where there's a capital gain, it has to be reported. But miscellaneous sales of clothes and that type of thing doesn't have to be reported. Here's another one that is sometimes confusing. A gift from someone does not have to be reported. So I talked to a lady on the telephone not long ago who had received a $10,000 gift from someone. And it was legitimately a gift. It was not is not income not to them. So gifts is not income either. Basically, it's what you earn, either through investments or by selling your time through wages.
One thing, of course, right now we're all sensitive to would be record keeping.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of records do we need to keep and for how long? In other words, maybe we've just filed our return. We're planning to do it in the next week or so. We have records we need to keep in case we're audited. How long do we keep them? What do we keep?
Well, I counsel that you keep a file for each year that you file your tax return, which has a copy of your tax return in it, all of the W-2s, 1099s, and the checks that support the deductions that you take. And if you keep that type of information for 5 years, that's adequate, and then you can throw it away if need be.
Ron, we're encouraging our listeners to write in to get a copy of a little card that they can send to the Social Security Administration to check out whether or not they've been properly credited with their earnings. Do you advise this?
Oh, yes. I think it's surprising sometimes to people to realize what they have accumulated in the way of a future benefit. Most people kind of write off Social Security in their minds when, in fact, they're putting a substantial sum away that will provide a substantial benefit potentially in the future.
Ron, tax day is fast approaching. One of the classic passages in the New Testament relative to taxes, and that's when our Lord was confronted in Luke chapter 20, verses 21 through 25. He was confronted by those that wanted to trip him up. And they said, hey, who does this coin belong to? And they showed him a denarius. And his response was, who's on the coin? Whose likeness? Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, give to God's what is God's. And we have a biblical obligation to pay taxes. There is a stewardship question involved, and that is not paying more than we legitimately owe.
No, exactly.
I'm wondering, Ron, what are some of the common pitfalls that we get into when it comes to taxes and filing our taxes?
Well, let me answer that question not from the commonly missed deductions, perhaps, or the mistakes that are made in filing a tax return. But I think that the number one mistake that I see is that when people get a tax refund.
Wait a minute, refund? That sounds positive to a lot of people. What do you mean?
Well, what I mean by that is that if you get a tax refund, what that means is that you have not planned your taxes the year before, and therefore you've either paid too much in estimates or withholding, and you get a refund. And my counsel is the government doesn't require that you pay in any more than you owe, and as a matter of fact, you don't even have to pay in all of what you're going to owe. And most people over-withhold or overpay on their estimates, which is really a sign of poor planning rather than good stewardship.
But there's a person out there saying, but Mr. Blue, this is the money that is kind of a savings for me, and I get it back, and it's so much fun.
Yeah, well, that's true. But what it really is saying is I don't have the discipline to save that money, and therefore I'll let the government have it on an interest-free basis for a year, and then they'll give it back to me in a lump sum. And that's just a sign of poor discipline. But the reality is, if you've planned your taxes, those taxes on April 15 should be no surprise. You should have the savings set aside for them, and certainly don't get a refund.
I appreciate the fact you shoot straight. I really do. I appreciate it more than you would ever imagine. You bring it down to habit patterns. You bring it down to attitudes. And that's where this game is won or lost. There's no two ways about it.
Yeah, and I think that goes along with the second biggest mistake that I see, and that is those that are really sloppy in the preparation of their return. They don't know what they can take as deductions. They don't know how to prepare a return. Maybe they spend $50 or $100 to have somebody prepare their return when they don't need to. Taxes are a very distasteful thing to people for some reason.
I think a lot of us, first of all, are not disciplined in the day-to-day, so we come to tax time and we suddenly have to go gather up all our receipts. And how much money did I give? Can I write that off? And how many insurance premiums do I have, that, you know, medical premiums, that I could conceivably write a portion of those off? And so I think we feel we're so far behind already. That's why right now, as we're approaching the end of tax season, or I guess maybe from the beginning for many people, we can begin to establish some of those disciplines.
Yes.
So that when we come into the end of this year, we're able to really confront the tax problems we have head on and deal with our return, get it filed, and do so correctly.
Yeah. In fact, my one piece of counsel, John, would be that, number one, do your return yourself this year, and then immediately set down your plan for 1987 and do your tax calculation for 1987 and set your withholding so that you don't get a refund in 1988.
As we come to this, I think we can probably save some people who have yet to file a lot of headaches and heartache as they stop and say, oh, do I itemize or don't I? Can you give us some counsel on how we know when we should itemize? Let's talk about 1986 at this point.
Okay, 1986, if you have itemized deductions, which are interest, sales tax, charitable contributions, some level of medical deductions, some miscellaneous deductions like employee business expenses that total more than $3,760 for a married couple, then you should itemize. And if it's below that, then you use the standard deduction. Everybody gets the $3,760 deduction, standard deduction. And if it's more than that, then you can itemize. And most certainly anybody that can itemize should itemize because it's to your benefit.
I had one preacher, a good friend, who would get up and say, if you're not itemizing, you're not giving enough. There's quite a bit of truth to that,
well,
I guess.
Is. Yeah, the average giving in the United States, I think, is 1.7% of adjusted gross income.
You told me last time evangelicals is only like 2.5%.
2.5% for evangelicals, that's right. So I think that's a good point.
If it is a good 10% or beyond, you probably should be itemizing.
Yeah, if it's 10% of the total income, it most certainly is greater than 10% of the adjusted gross income. And most certainly you should be itemizing.
Well, in addition to the fact that some of us are allowing the IRS to use our money and we're getting a refund, and that is not the way to go about it, what other pitfalls do you see when it comes to tax planning and especially filing our taxes?
Well, I think another big one is a short-term perspective. And that is, I'll do my tax planning, maybe beginning about the middle of December, because I know that I've only got 2 weeks left to do any tax planning. And by that time in the year, it's just too late to do any tax planning. Additionally, maybe even a bigger mistake from a dollar standpoint is making tax-motivated decisions. For example, I got a real big kick out of all of the car ads and consumer item ads at the end of the last year. You know, the last year to let the government help you buy that BMW or that new Cutlass or whatever it may be. And, yes, it's true that the sales tax deduction is lost and the interest deduction is being phased out on consumer items. But to make a $10,000 decision on the basis of a $300 tax savings doesn't seem to be a real wise one.
Well, you say in your book, and again, your book, Master Your Money, is an incredible piece of work that we encourage everyone. Thousands of people got it through our office. We would encourage you to go to your Christian bookstore and secure a copy. You have little boxes in there that offset some key thoughts and principles. And one that I read just this morning, reread, said, never make a financial decision based on its tax deductibility. And that's what you're saying.
I see what I'm saying exactly.
See, in light of that, I was watching these commercials thinking of you at Christmas time. I mean, it was like a panic, you know, like you're going to save all this $100, $200 on your taxes at most, and you're going to be spending all this money. And you're absolutely right.
Yeah, and it's astounding to me, and yet it is so easy to fall into the trap, because when you're bombarded with advertising and when your friends are doing it, you begin to think, well, am I missing the boat? Have I missed something here?
I'll tell you, the media doesn't understand it either.
No.
Because they start to pick it up, and I don't think they understand it. It's almost as if the sales tax is $500, you're going to get $500. That's not true.
Oh, good point.
You're going to get a $500 deduction, which means you may save $100.
Yeah, if you're in the 20% tax bracket,
then you save $100.
Then you save $100. So you've made, again, a $5,000 decision and saved $100 on it. And that's hardly good financial decision-making.
Mm. Well, one area, too, that isn't it this year that we still can get an extra deduction if both spouses work, husband and wife both work?
1986 was that
87
year.
Will be eliminated.
87, it's eliminated permanently. And that deduction was $3,000. Up to $3,000 of income could be excluded from income of a working spouse. But that's gone after 86.
Let's assume that I've been listening to you or started to think through my tax situation. Maybe I went to someone and didn't give them the complete information, and I find right now that, hey, I made a mistake. I've already filed. I've made a mistake. What can a person do?
Well, you can file what's called a Form 1040X, which is an amended return. It's a very simple form to file, and go back and redo your taxes in effect. Actually, it's a one-page form, 1040X. The IRS will send it to you, or you can stop at their office and get it. Probably can get it in a bank also. And you just put the corrected numbers on the 1040X and send it in, and if it's to your benefit, they'll send you a check. If you owe, then you attach a check.
But it does open you up to further scrutiny plus additional auto potential.
Oh, sure. But again, if it's an honest mistake that was made, that's no problem. And as a matter of fact, very few 1040Xs get audited unless they are, maybe it's in the tax shelter area. A lot of people that file amended returns because of tax shelter losses or security sales or something, they might get audited. But say it's a mistake. I didn't include $500 worth of charitable deductions that I found. Amend the return and get the check, and even if they do audit you, fine, you've got the support for it, but the chances of them auditing you are very, very slim.
As you make the statement, never make a financial decision based on its deductibility, I think of so many men in this city, the city of Dallas, who are right now losing everything because they worked with syndication, different things that depended upon the tax implications in order for the thing to work, for the deal to work.
That's right.
And now, right now, they are going under. And I am seeing an incredible heartache in this city and across the nation, really, because of some of the tax law changes, where everything was based upon deductibility, and now it's no longer deductible.
Yeah, when I was practicing as a CPA doing tax returns, every April I would go through this trauma with people, and they would always say to me, well, how can I reduce my taxes? And I had a stock answer, but I think it made a point. And I say it facetiously, but I said it's easy to reduce your taxes, just reduce your income. And the point is that the only people that pay taxes are those that have, in effect, surplus income. And nobody is taxed 100% on their income. So even if you were in the maximum tax brackets and paying at the 50% level in 1986, an extra $10,000 was an extra $5,000 in your pocket. Now, people made tax-motivated decisions, and they said, I don't want to pay that $5,000. So they took on debt, generally, to buy investments where they could write off depreciation and interest. But whenever you add debt to an investment, it becomes a much higher risky type of transaction, and therefore, now when the economy turned down, they're losing it. And it is a sad, sad day in the lives of many Christians. They're losing their testimony as well as what all they've accumulated and worked to accumulate it.
Proverbs chapter 21 and verse 20 says, in the house of the wise are stores of choice food and oil, but a foolish man devours all he has. In other words, the foolish man consumes all he has. The wise man saves some of what he has. We're going to talk about savings, but especially in light of retirement. Ron, first of all, something I have had to grapple with personally is there a contradiction between retirement planning and the life of faith? Are we depending on God if we're putting money aside for the future?
Well, that's a good question, and I think there's two extremes. One extreme would say you save nothing, and the other extreme would say that accumulation is a sign of spirituality. And frankly, I don't think that the Bible supports either one. I don't think that the Bible says that it's a wise man who is poverty-stricken. He's probably a victim of circumstances. So I don't think that you give it all away and don't save, nor do I think that you judge your spirituality by how much you accumulate. And I guess maybe the simplest way for me to answer that is I think that you need to live day by day, but you live with a long-term perspective. We can plan on 65, 70, 75 years to live on this earth, and to end up a working life with very little accumulated is a poor stewardship decision. Somebody's going to have to take care of you.
The illustration of the ant in Proverbs, I think, helps to show us that here he puts a little aside, and it shows the wisdom of the ant to do that. And so I don't think it's that we're not trusting God. It's primarily a stewardship issue.
Yeah, I think it really is. And, for example, if someone were to begin at age 25 setting aside $1,000 a year in an IRA, let's say, or some other retirement-type vehicle, and they were able to average 12.5% return on that over a 40-year working life, so they would have put away $40,000 and averaged 12.5%. At the end of their working life, they would actually have $1 million. And it's not that hard to become a millionaire.
And again, it's time plus return.
That's right.
That gives us that equation.
Uh-huh.
What investment vehicles do you recommend for retirement? There are a number of different ones. Maybe you could highlight a couple.
Let me answer that question with, first of all, what would I recommend in the way of investments? Because I believe that there is a sequential investment strategy that most Americans, Christian or non-Christian, should fall into. Number one in that sequential strategy, and you can view it as a stair step, is you need step number one is you need to pay off all your credit card debt before you make any investments, because that gives you an immediate return of 18 to 21%. That's the best investment you can
make. Let me repeat that. Okay, pay off your credit cards, because immediately you're saving the 18% you'd be giving to the credit card company.
That's right. Before you set up an IRA, or buy a tax shelter, buy a rental home or anything, do that. Second step is to set aside at least 1 month's living expenses in your checking account. That is so that you're never caught behind. So if you have not yet paid off your credit cards and saved enough to have a month ahead, then you're not ready to invest either. Thirdly, I believe that you should have maybe another 3 to 6 months of savings set aside for emergencies, medical or major purchases like a car or something like that. And again, if you haven't reached that step, you're not ready to invest.
Now, where would you put that money, though? You wouldn't keep that in your checking account, would you?
No, I wouldn't keep it in a checking account. I'd put it in a bank or in a money market fund, depending on the amount of it.
So in other words, it has accessibility, but it's not locked in where
That's
you can't
right.
get to it.
It's not an investment. It's a savings amount.
Okay.
Okay, and then fourthly, saving for long-term goals, such as a car or maybe a down payment on a home or perhaps to pay off debt or to do something that's of a significant amount. And that money also should be invested in a savings account or a money market fund. Then and only then are you ready to begin investing in such things as IRAs, mutual funds, and real estate, but only until you reach that. And very few really ever reach that last stage. So,
what about someone like myself who has already gone through the last step and doesn't really have all in between? Maybe has partially. In other words, I don't have 3 to 6 months salary put aside. I maybe could have up to a month's salary put aside, but in other words, the tax deductibility, of course, is an attractive feature that doesn't seem like we'll ever get there if we're trying to save 3 to 6 months income.
Well, again, you've got to be careful of making a tax-motivated decision. And I really believe for long-term financial security is you go back and you start over. And you see where you are on that stair step. And you do that. Now, some may say, well, I don't need that 3 to 6 months because I have wealthy parents. Or I have an investment over here that I could always sell that I've already made. And that's okay. You're going to modify it for your own circumstances. But I do think the principles of paying off all of the debt and having money set aside for emergencies and having money set aside in savings programs for major purchases mm-hmm. before you begin investing are good principles to follow.
Well, let's come to that last stage. Let's talk about IRAs. Let's talk about KEO plans, HR 10 plans. I'm sitting here. I want to start to put some money away. You know, I don't even know what an IRA is. How would you define it?
Well, an IRA is a retirement plan. It's a personal retirement plan. It's just like the pension plan that you have at work, except that you get to put money away yourself in it. And basically, you can open up an IRA with an insurance company, with a bank, with a brokerage house, many, many vehicles to open an IRA, but it is your own personal retirement plan. And that's all that it is.
Now, these have variations. There are self-directed plans, and there are plans that are directed by the bank or the financial institution.
Right.
If I'm not very sophisticated, I guess really I got to go pretty much with a predefined plan, typically?
Yes, typically, and I would suggest that if you're unclear about that or unsophisticated about it, that you go ahead and go to a bank or a brokerage house or an insurance company and open up that IRA. But I would not commit funds for a long-term amount. For example, I would not lock in interest rates today at 6.5% or 8% for 10 years.
Would you do it for 3 years?
Well, probably would for 3 years, but no longer than that.
Okay.
Because we just don't know what's going to happen in the next 3 years in terms of interest rates. So if I were going to go to a bank, I would probably open it up with a one-year CD or a two-year CD, or maybe a three-year CD if the rate is significantly high.
Especially higher. Since interest rates right now are so low.
So low, that's right. I like to see interest rates on that type of investment in a float. In other words, go up and down with the changes in our economy.
I can give a very practical word here, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I invested in an IRA and did it for 18 months. And believe me, at 18 months, when that comes due to be reinvested, no one could care about an IRA anywhere in the city of Dallas. So you have to time it, I found, you have to time it so that it's when there's a lot of competition with the interest rates.
That's right.
And here I was in mid-year, and no one, IRA, it's like, what is it?
Yes.
See, so I had found that you do invest it for at least 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, so it comes due at a competitive time to reinvest or roll over.
Yeah, and I recommend banks and insurance companies for those that are getting started in it with their IRAs. However, I believe that once you reach a certain level, maybe it's $6,000 or $10,000 in your IRAs, you begin to diversify those investments. And then you roll over all your IRAs into what's called a self-directed IRA. And then I recommend that they diversify, maybe a third in money market funds or CDs, perhaps a third in growth mutual funds, and perhaps a third in unleveraged real estate. Now, obviously, by the time you get into that type of investment, you may need to consult with an expert, or, frankly, you can go to almost any newsstand and get all the information you want on mutual funds, unleveraged real estate, money market funds, CDs, and so forth. It's not a question of there not being information or people trying to trick you. It's more a question of discipline. There's a lot of information available.
Ron, I guess really for many of us, it's a question of speculation versus security. And, of course, the interest rate and return we get are all interplayed in those two questions.
Yes. Remember, why are you doing an IRA? And the reason you're doing an IRA is to fund a portion of your retirement. In other words, to make yourself at some point in time financially independent so you're not dependent upon someone else to care for you. Therefore, you can't afford to lose that money, and it should be in the safest types of investments. So when I talk banks and certificates of deposit or insurance companies with fixed interest rates or variable interest rates, those are the types of investments that you're always going to be able to get your principal amount back, period. You should do no speculation whatsoever with an IRA investment.
I guess, Ron, too, though, one of the warnings you would give at this point would be there are penalties for early withdrawal as well. Not only should we have a secure, growing investment, But we got to make sure that we don't have to access it too soon because there is a penalty involved, I understand.
Yes, there is a 10% penalty if you withdraw the IRA before age 59 and a half. Should that stop you from doing an IRA? Absolutely not, because if you really do need the money, you can get it. But you should not put money into an IRA that is a part of your short-term savings program. That you know you will need to access, and therefore you should have that available. It says in Proverbs, for example, that the ant gathers little by little, and in the New International Version, in Proverbs, I think that's 6:11, mm-hmm. It says that he who gathers money little by little causes it to grow. And it specifically says money there causes it to grow.
Causes it to grow. I think back, too, to Joseph when he had his dream, or he interpreted the Pharaoh's dream, actually. And he was able to interpret the dream that there would be 7 years of plenty, 7 years of famine. And their response was, hey, let's live by faith the 7 years of famine. No, it wasn't.
That's their response
was, let's put aside during the 7 years of plenty to prepare for the 7 years of famine.
Yeah, absolutely. And those that don't plan for the future are, in essence, being very, very foolish. What they're saying is, the future will take care of itself, and that's not biblical. God calls us to be planners.
Well, first of all, what do I look for in an IRA? Let's review a little bit of what we said yesterday. Where do I get it? What do I look for?
Well, an IRA, of course, is a self-retirement plan. It's your own personal retirement plan, and the Tax Reform Act of 1986 changed the way that you can use an IRA and the amounts that you can put into an IRA. But what it did leave was still the basic IRA concept. And any couple that has an adjusted gross income of $40,000 or less, regardless of any other pension plans that they participate in, still can get a $2,000 deduction for an IRA for each wage earner, up mm-hmm. to $2,000 per wage earner.
Maybe you could define adjusted gross income. That's after several deductions.
Yes, that's after some of the adjustments like for pension plans and so forth, moving expenses in 1986, employee business expenses in 1986, all of those reduced the gross income down to the adjusted gross income. And anyone who has an adjusted gross income in 1986 of anything can put $2,000 into an IRA, or up to $2,000 into an IRA.
We are still in a position, though, to also write off an IRA, for 1986, even now, before April 15th.
Yes. As a matter of fact, it is until April 15th, you can make an IRA contribution for 1986 and deduct it on your 1986 tax return.
All things being considered, we discussed yesterday, we certainly recommend that, wouldn't we?
Yes, and I would recommend one other thing, and that is that if you're going to qualify for an IRA deduction in 1987, that you do it immediately, because you get the benefit of tax-free compounding working for you earlier than if you wait until April 15th of 1988 to do your 1987 contribution.
I think the point you're making needs to be elaborated on. I didn't understand this, but someone told me not to wait until April 15th and do it in terms of making the investment. But if you were just to invest even in December for that year, the same amount of money, it's an incredible impact at the end as to how much money you make.
Yes, and I don't have the exact number in front of me, but if you invested $2,000 per year in IRA, and the earliest that you could do it would be January 1 of the tax year. So mm-hmm. the earliest that I could have done an IRA for 1987 was January 1, 1987. The latest that I can do it is April 15th, 1988. If I wait until April 15th each year to make the previous year's IRA contribution, and the interest rate is like 10% that I could earn on my IRA contribution, just the delay in 15 months causes something like a $25,000 difference in the amount that I actually have at retirement.
Now, it's my understanding the law does have a profound impact on individual retirement accounts, but that law is different for this year, 87, and it's also different for 88, as I understand it.
Well, 87 and 88 and 89 are the same, but 86 is the last year that you could take the full $2,000 IRA contribution, regardless of any pension plans. The law basically says in 1987 that if you're covered under any other pension plan, you can't take an IRA unless your adjusted gross income as a couple is less than $40,000, and then the law is the same as it was in 1986. Now, between $40,000 and $50,000, you can still make the IRA contribution and take it as a deduction, but it is phased down from $2,000 to zero on a pro rata basis. And then, if you're covered by another pension plan after $50,000 of adjusted gross income, you do not get the IRA deduction. However, you can still put the money into an IRA and get the tax-free compounding. And so my recommendation is that regardless of whether you can deduct it or not, you should be making an IRA contribution and allowing that money to build up to on a tax-free basis.
Now, you just dumped the truck, okay? If you don't mind, I'm going to walk you back through that a little bit, because people like myself need to hear it a second time, I think.
You can still make an IRA deduction. Take a $2,000 deduction if you have $2,000 or more of earned income.
So even if your wife, say, made $2,500 and you made $30,000, you could still file $2,000 for her, $2,000 for yourself.
That is correct.
That's for 1986.
Right.
Now, in 1987, the dynamic changes just a bit. If I'm covered at work with some kind of a pension plan, then what can I do?
Well, if your adjusted gross income as a couple is less than $40,000, then you can still take a $2,000 deduction for both of you if you make that contribution. Okay, now if your income as a couple goes above $40,000 but is below $50,000, you can still make an IRA contribution, take a deduction, but it's on a reducing amount, going from $2,000 down to zero, mm-hmm. between $40,000 and $50,000.
And if that weren't confusing enough, let's assume we're over $50,000.
Okay.
We do not qualify for the deduction itself. We can still invest $2,000 per wage earner.
That is correct.
And that money can accumulate in terms of the interest tax-free.
That is correct. So, therefore, my counsel again is everyone should be putting money into an IRA. Some, it will be deductible fully. Others, it will be deductible partially. And others, it won't be deductible. But all will benefit from the tax-free compounding.
And what we just described is effective for 87, 88, and 89.
That is
correct.
That
the way it looks right now?
Yes.
Ron, there's something that was recommended to me that I'd be curious to get your counsel on. And what I hope to do, by the way, in the months ahead, is as we get letters from our listeners asking questions, of course, you can't answer all those letters. What I'd like to do is start to share some of those with you. Maybe we can begin to counsel people directly from their letters.
Well,
so we encourage people to write in. I'm just wondering, I was encouraged to borrow money to invest in a retirement plan. How do you feel about that?
Well, let's take it from a just a practical matter. How are you going to pay the money back? Were you counseled as to where the money was going to come from?
Well, it was almost like a forced situation where you'd have to each month start to pay back on it, like you would almost a car loan or something.
Okay. I would say that if you didn't have a guaranteed way to pay it back, to take on debt for any reason is a foolish thing to do. So my counsel would be absolutely don't borrow to make an investment. That's how so many people got into trouble that you and I talked about
mm-hmm.
Earlier here in Texas and in other parts of the country, by borrowing to make an investment. I don't think you should ever borrow to make an investment. Let me just leave it at that without getting into the rationale. Don't borrow to make an investment, including an IRA.
Now, some people would come back and say, well, wait a minute. I get the deduction, so I save a few $100 there. The money is still there. I can access it if I had to. All I'm going to lose is maybe a 10% penalty.
Yes, and they would also say that you get to deduct the interest, potentially.
Right.
This year it's on a pro rata basis, and therefore it has to make good sense. But I come back and say, well, where's the money going to come from to pay it back? And I would rather see people being saving to have the funds available to do that rather than to presume upon the future by borrowing in order to do that kind of investment. It's a trap that you can fall into. And I guess the biblical principle that it would violate more than any other is to presume upon the future. And I would not counsel to do that.
You say something, I believe it's in your book, or you said this in the last time we were together, that the average American, when they retire, has how much money? It's...
Well, the average...
Probably little.
Yes. Only 2% of Americans end up financially independent, according to the Social Security Board. And according to Devney's economic tables, the average amount for Americans over 65 that they have in way of liquidity would be $250.
Wait a minute. $250.
That's correct. Therefore, they haven't planned.
And see, from my perspective, in terms of my concern about the family living biblically in the home, what I see happening is a heavy burden that's being placed on relationships in the home because of that failure to plan.
That's right.
The tension goes up, the anxiety. Right now, I have a number of friends whose parents are elderly and trying to deal with their situations where their health is not good, they do not have financial resources, and the incredible burden it becomes. Now, I believe biblically we have an obligation to minister, to serve, to take them under our roof. But if they had planned, this whole process would have been a lot easier.
Oh, yeah. And that's poor stewardship to not plan for the future. And it is so easy to do. Again, come back to the illustration of $1,000 a year for 40 years. Now, people are going to be saying, yeah, but I'm 55 or I'm 60. Well, I believe that you start where you are.
And do the best you can.
And you do the best that you can. You maybe have made some mistakes, but God's a God that forgives us. And
mm-hmm.
perhaps if I'm obedient from this point on, He's going to do some unusual things to allow me to end up where he would have me to end up financially.
I really appreciate your counsel. I want you to know, since last time we were together, every time I buy something, I have ringing in my ears Ron Blue saying, save $2.74 a day. It's $1,000 a year, compounded. I mean, I've got it figured out. So you've got me on a guilt complex every time I spend a dime.
Well, I hope it's a stewardship complex.
It's a good one. It really is. Ron, we want to talk about the implications of the new tax law, but let's keep in mind once again that biblically we are told this is a stewardship issue. I think of Luke chapter 16 and verse 10. He was faithful in a very little thing, is faithful also in much. He was unrighteous in a little thing, is unrighteous in much. If we're faithful with unrighteous mammon, as God says, he'll entrust to us the greater treasures, their spiritual treasures. Ron, good to have you back.
Good to be here, John.
Overall, what type of an impact will the new tax law have on the average taxpayer? Will I pay more taxes, less taxes, the same?
Well, I think the average taxpayer is probably going to pay the same or less. The one that probably gets hurt the most is maybe those with incomes in the $50,000 to $100,000 total income level. They're probably going to pay more. And those above $100,000 are going to lose a lot of the tax benefits that they had, and if they were relying on such things as tax shelters to reduce their income, they're going to pay a lot more in taxes. But if they were not relying on tax shelters, they're going to have to pay less in taxes also. Overall, John, I think that the Tax Act was good for the person who is following good stewardship principles and trying to just plan and manage his money and not try to use gimmicks to reduce his taxes.
And, of course, the principle you gave us earlier in the week of not trying to spend money with deductibility in mind would have saved a lot of heartache for a lot of people today.
Yes.
Because
yes.
of the elimination of certain deductions that people were building financial empires on.
That's right.
Do you think the new law will ultimately make it easier for us to file our taxes? There's a lot of confusion right now. It seems like it's gotten more complicated rather than easier. Do you think in the long run it's going to kind of work its way out?
Well, I've never seen a tax simplification that was that made filing a tax return simpler. And this one has created a lot of confusion, but again, I have found that the government in the instruction booklets is pretty good, so that don't throw up your hands would be my advice and walk away from it because of the complexity. You can still do your own return, and I think over time it will become simpler to work on. 1987 is a transitional year, and it is more complex than what 1988 will be. But people can still do their own tax returns, and I would recommend that they do that, but it's not a simple process, unless you're in lower income levels, and then the tax return's been eliminated totally.
Ron, certain exemptions have changed in 1987, and of course will continue to be changed or will be differentiated in years ahead. What are some of those that we should be aware of?
Well, I think let's distinguish, John, between an exemption and a deduction. An exemption is an arbitrary amount that we are allowed to reduce our income by on the basis of our family and age characteristics, period. For example, I have 5 children and 1 wife, so I have 7 in my family.
Glad to hear you only have 1 wife.
Yes.
We're into that here on this program. Go ahead.
Well, with 5 children, some may wonder.
No.
But we have a family of 7, and they are all supported by me, and therefore I have 5 personal exemptions for the children and 2 for my wife and I.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if either one of us were over 65, we would have another partial exemption, and if either one of us were blind, we would have another partial exemption.
I see.
But that's an exemption. On the other hand, a deduction is an amount that I'm allowed to deduct from my income on the basis of spending money. For example, charitable contributions or interest or, in the past, sales tax or medical expenses or professional fees and that type of thing. So we're talking about exemptions.
Now, the exemptions have gone up, I understand it.
Yes. Last year, 1986, the exemptions were $1,080 per dependent and per taxpayer. So again, using myself as an example, I had 7 times 1,080 was the amount that I was able to reduce my income by before I calculated the taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 1987, that number has increased dramatically to $1,900. So I get a deduction again of 7 times $1,900. A dramatic increase. 1988, that number goes to $1,950 per exemption. And then in 1989, it goes to $2,000 and stays there. The idea was that it was to help the lower income person and those with larger families just to offset some of the tax burden. So it is a dramatic plus for most people.
A real big help to the family, of course,
oh, yeah.
too, because people are in higher tax brackets, wealthier people. It's not that important to them to have that personal exemption increase. But for those that are making less money, it certainly is.
Yes, as a matter of fact, a family of seven, for example, in 1989, they would have $14,000. Their first $14,000 of income would not be taxed because of the personal exemptions. Then there was, in addition to that, an increase in the standard deduction up to $5,000. So they could have an income of $19,000 and pay no taxes on it. So it was a family-motivated change in the Tax Act.
Personal exemptions have gone up, but a lot of deductions have been eliminated or certainly have gone down.
Well, a few have gone down or have been phased out, but I don't really consider them significant.
Mm-hmm.
The significant deductions that were left were the interest on the home and the charitable contributions. There was no change in any of those. The things that have been lost were the sales tax deduction, but that was a pretty minor amount. I doubt if most people ever deducted over $300 or $400 for sales tax.
Especially if you use the tables that they give
you. Right. Unless you bought a car or a boat or something like that, then the deduction was higher. And that has gone. The second thing that is being phased out is the consumer interest, which is interest on car debt, credit card debt, consumer-type items, payment-type items. And this year, you can only deduct 65% of your consumer interest, and it's 40% the following year and 20% in 1989, and then it goes to zero.
So if somebody has paid $100 on their Visa bill this year of interest, $100 of interest on their Visa bill, they can only write off $75.
$65. And when we say this year, we're talking 1987.
Right.
In 1986, had they paid $100 on a Visa bill for interest, they would get to deduct the full $100.
You know, that excites me because they're finally discouraging consumer debt.
That's exactly
by
right.
doing that.
Exactly right. That's one of the reasons that I was a proponent of the tax change was because it discourages consumer debt and it encourages the family, if you will, by raising the personal exemptions.
And, of course, the interest on the home, on our dwelling, is still deductible.
Yes, 100%. Now, there have been some more complex rules added on how much you can deduct on the interest on the home, but basically it is whatever the cost of the home was originally, plus the improvements that you've added to the home, you can have a mortgage up to that amount and deduct fully the interest. Additionally, you can deduct the interest on a second home. If you have a vacation home, for example, that interest is fully deductible. So one of the sanctities of American life is the home, and the government preserved the interest deduction on the home.
One area, of course, that has changed somewhat is the area of charitable contributions. It's my understanding that if you do not itemize, you will not be able to deduct. Is that right?
That is correct. If you use the standard deduction in the past, 1986 and before, you could still deduct your charitable contributions. That has been lost. But at the same time, the standard deduction has gone up. So it's not really a significant
offsets it to some degree.
Yeah, change in the tax law.
If you itemize, do you receive the same credit as you did in previous years?
Yes, no change on that, including, for example, the gift of appreciated property. Is fully deductible for the full fair market value of the gift that you make.
Super. Ron, I appreciate this week of ministry. We had some people listening who are struggling with their taxes. They'd really like to get it together. What encouragement could you give to them?
Well, I guess, first of all, that God is interested in my faithfulness, and He's the one that is the source of the income that I have. I don't have to cheat on my tax return. I don't have to do anything that I couldn't look God right straight in the face and say I did it exactly as it was required. I'm commanded to obey. And if you're running short on money and you're looking to reduce expenses someplace, don't start by cheating on your income taxes. Now, I know most of the listeners are not, but I just want to encourage them that God honors those who are faithful. Just be faithful in the preparation of your tax return.
He's sitting there with us as we prepare it.
That's right.
Again, our guest has been Ron Blue, a good friend, author of the book Master Your Money. Ron, I want to get you back real soon. Talk about some other important areas about family finance.
I look forward to coming back, John.